Listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour, we're going to be talking about all things food and drink. I'm joined by my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Sapling Digital and co-founder of Food Rush. Hello, Guy.
Hello.
Have you got over drinking that grappa last week? That was pretty strong.
I quite enjoyed it, actually. But I like a drink from time to time.
No, I didn't like that. Did you take some home?
No, I had some gin to take home.
Ollie swiped it, yeah. Which leads me to Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs.
Hi, how's it going?
Yes, good. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We are joined by somebody else. I'm terribly sorry. Is distiller again.
So we've got more gin.
Yeah, I'm afraid we have.
And other distilled things.
Another distilled things. That's because the UK is leading in this area of gin production, I suspect, at the moment.
Well, I guess London dry gin is quite a famous concept, but I guess they do make it all over the world. I'm sure our guests can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, so we've got Will Edge of Green Sand Ridge Distillery.
Hello.
Is it originally in Holland, juniper?
Well, the principle of distillation originates in Mesopotamia, in Islamic cultures, and they don't drink alcohol, so it originated to create a solvent to pull all the lovely natural oils out of botanicals. So the Moors brought the technology to Spain, and then it came up through Spain, and then the French got hold of it and discovered they could do something cool with their table wine.
Which they did.
Yeah.
Mm. So it's about using that medium to draw flavours out.
Exactly.
Which is what all these botanicals are about.
That's what all these botanicals are about.
Except that we really have adopted it in the UK, haven't we? We like our gin.
We do like gin, yeah. We've got the wars with France to thank for that.
Yeah,
because brandy at one point was banned, and so we adopted the Dutch style of alcohol gin, or Geneva as it was, and we did fall in love with it rather.
Mm. And the same could be said of port, because we were arguing with the French again. Again, port became popular over here because people couldn't get hold of brandy and red wine and stuff like that. So whenever we have an argument with France, it seems we have another type of booze that comes along.
Just ask the question in a year and a bit's time, what might be the impact of Brexit, apart from the fact we all need to drink a lot?
That's a very, very good question.
We need a bingo card for this show for every time that one of us says something stupid or talks about booze or talks
politics.
About politics and Brexit.
So, Will, we're going to be talking about your distillery very soon. We're also joined by Jason Gibb of Bread and Jam. And if any of you haven't been to Bread and Jam, it's a great event. I think it started 2 years ago and about to hit the third year this year. Guy, you've been to every one, haven't you?
I went to the first one. I hosted a panel at the first one about the future of food, which was very good fun. And just always hearing so many positive things about the event. It's really well organized. It's got an amazing venue, and it's really needed in the industry, especially with a lot of the small producers. It's a great place for them to go to meet each other and to get advice and to workshop and all sorts of good stuff like that.
So Jason, given the glowing reviews you've got from both of us,
thank you very much. I'm quite honored.
I just find it really interesting. Can you just explain exactly what the Bread and Jam Fest is actually about?
So basically, from being an entrepreneur myself, I kind of realized that our community is going through a lot of the same experiences. We're making the same mistakes, we're struggling in the same way, and there's a set of problems which are actually quite easy to solve. So I thought, well, why don't we put together something that basically trains people to overcome those problems? Another thing about being an entrepreneur is that you are very, having made all those mistakes, you're very willing to share them with other people.
I've never come across that in any other sector as much as the food sector.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Though.
I don't know why.
You're really generous.
Passing on that wisdom and information that you've earned. I, the way I see it is when you make a mistake, one of the few good things about it is that you can help someone else. So through that, I've been able to kind of assemble an amazing kind of lineup of speakers and work people to run workshops to basically help people avoid a lot of the obvious mistakes with starting or building a food or drink business.
But many of us who organise events, you know, trying to get speakers is a nightmare. People are busy, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But you have the most astounding set of speakers. Is that because they generally do want to help and put a little bit back? You know, they're very much aligned to what you're trying to do.
There's certainly that element. Yes, there's that element. But also, I am a food entrepreneur myself. I've been doing it for 15 years. And a lot of the people that I've got to speak, certainly in the first years, were people that I grew up with and that I knew and were, I was pulling favours. But now it's becoming, you know, not an honour, but it's a nice thing to be asked to speak at our event in a certain way. So we
gives you a bit of recognition.
Yeah, it gives you a bit of recognition. Yeah. So it's relatively straightforward, but the getting speakers. But the key is also that. By the fact that I've been through it myself, I kind of know the different elements. So the content of the program is quite good. You know, it touches on all the different aspects, all the likely places where you're likely to mess up.
And what I found is it at the Institute of Directors again?
It is.
Yes, that's at Pall Mall, right in the middle of London here, Piccadilly. And what I really enjoyed is there's loads of different rooms and there's something going on all the time. So you can stand and there'll be a plenary session where somebody will stand up and talk about what they've done and how they've overcome some of those things. You've then got a sort of little surgery sessions where you can book in, talk to a real buyer, like from Selfridges or somewhere like that, and get their feedback, their honest feedback about the what they've produced and their packaging and everything, and there's a lot of networking going on. So it's a really interesting mix, isn't it?
Yeah. So we got the kind of thought leaders and keynote people, the people who started Innocent or Green and Blacks or brands like that, speaking in one room. Then we got the thing you were talking about, which is a tasting panel. You see, one thing that happens is that you make this great product and, you know, your mum and your best friend tell you it's the most wonderful thing that they've ever tasted. But the people who really count are the buyers.
Yeah.
And we rarely get any proper feedback from people like that. You might send your product into Selfridges and never hear anything back. You don't know if that's because they think it's rubbish or it's
they
the wrong timing or they didn't even get it. So this is a chance for a face-to-face interaction with a buyer where you're not selling to them, but you're asking them for their honest opinion. What do you think of the branding? What do you think of the price point? What do you think of the taste of the product? And that kind of information is invaluable. And another thing we have, talking about buyers, is one of the biggest issues with starting a food or drink retail product is access to buyers. There's like a brick wall between you and, you know, the buyers of whether it's M&S or Selfridges or whatever.
You can understand that though, because they would be inundated, wouldn't they? So you can understand that.
Absolutely. But what they get hundreds of products every day sent to them, and they're like, you know, they pile up on their desk, and it's for them it's a nightmare. For the food producer, it's a nightmare. So what we're doing is we're doing 10-minute sessions where you can apply to pitch your product to them, and if they choose you, you've got 10 minutes face-to-face with them. And the retailers love it because they can knock off 40 innovative brands in one afternoon. And the food producers love it because they're accessing the gatekeepers to their, you know, future growth.
For real. And they're not going to mince their words. I mean, they'll be polite, but they're going to be very, very honest, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which is exactly what you need, because this industry is tough and you don't want to lead someone down the path thinking, oh yeah, that's a nice idea, well done, when it's really not got any legs or, you know, doesn't fit nicely into one of the categories.
So this, what speakers have you got lined up so far? I mean, I know it's not till October the 4th and October the 5th this year, although you can get tickets now, which I advise you to do, especially if you want to get an
early bird station. Price.
And it's early bird price, even better. But I know you're still firming up some of your speakers. Who have you got already?
So this year, I start off with the keynote speakers, and we got the likes of the editor of The Grocer. We got the head food buyer of Ocado. We've got a head of food at Selfridges, a few people like that. So they're the kind of attention grabbers, but also the nitty gritty is in the other room, which is the panel room, where we have three entrepreneurs talking about a specific subject. Guy helped with one in the first year. So it's like any subject from how to raise seed funding or how to get your first retailer. And we have three people who've really been there and done it, often taken different approaches, because there's not one way to skin a cat. You know, you don't need to crowdfunding to kickstart your business. You could go for loans. You can go for friends and families and fools. You know, there's different ways of doing it.
I think Ollie's just that's done that, haven't you? Friends, families and fools for your crowdfunding.
We did our community.
Oh, yes, that's right.
That's definitely, that's foodies. That's the other one.
Yeah. But all of these are really important lessons to learn, aren't they? It's better to come to one of your events and really get some of that positive feedback than, you know, mortgage up your house and go for it and maybe not quite there yet.
Yeah, no, the earlier you can get these learnings, the more money you're going to save in the long run. And there's also, there's an incredible atmosphere at our event as well, because it's a real community that realises that the way to succeed is to support each other. Mm. So it goes much beyond just the learning. It's like finding your tribe. So I, you know, being an entrepreneur is a really lonely journey, and you're going through all these thoughts and rounding your head backwards and forwards. And if you can share it with someone who's going through the same stuff as you, it's such a relief.
Do you think people sometimes might leave disappointed because they feel that they've got some feedback which is not what they wanted, because everybody's told them what they're doing is lovely, and actually they've then realised that a food buyer is saying it's just not, you know, it's not different enough, and you know, the quality's not quite where some of the other things are. Do you think, I mean, maybe that's a good thing, but do you think some people do leave disappointed?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people who start a food business because they are passionate about their grandmother's recipe for jam or whatever. And those people will often, they may well struggle, because you've got to be really adaptable. You can't be set in your ways. You've got to be able to think, well, what does the market want? It's not necessarily what I'm bringing to it. You just got to be open for feedback and to learn and develop your product.
Because if you're going to take things personally, you're not going to get on very well, are you?
You've got
to dissociate yourself from the actual product and really view it dispassionately. Even if you're passionate about the thing, you need to make dispassionate business decisions.
My first business was an olive oil business that I did for 9 years. It started as a real kind of lifestyle project. We threw in our jobs as TV producers, bought an abandoned olive grove in Italy, moved over there.
Fantastic.
With our little daughter, harvested the trees, pruned the trees, and we were lucky enough to get our first harvest into Selfridges, and then it grew and we were in Waitrose and stuff. But all the time, I have to admit, I was way too close to the business. I couldn't make proper objective decisions about the long-term future of it. And it's only in subsequent businesses where I've still been incredibly passionate about it, but I've been able to kind of step back and think, you know, is that the right way to go?
Yeah.
And with this, my olive oil business, you know, the money in the bank account was my personal money. I took everything so personally. Mm. And you can't do that.
No, you can't, because sometimes then you won't make the right decision.
Yeah.
Ollie, you've had a sort of background in brands. Brands will be dispassionate, won't they, about what they, you know, the big businesses, because there's so much to lose, I guess. And they will make very far-reaching sort of business decisions, won't they?
I think in some ways... not. I mean, I think I always remember when I worked at Unilever, I remember that Unilever decided to relist Sun into the UK, the dishwasher detergent brand, because the chairman's wife didn't like the fact that she had to buy a Procter & Gamble product. It took £3 million and they tried to launch that brand.
Is that normal though?
Well, I've heard a lot of those kind of stories.
Right.
And I think there is, you know, I think what actually gets in the way often is not the dispassionate place, it's ego. Mm. And I think the biggest danger on some of this stuff is that... you know, because I think for any of us who've set up our own businesses and done stuff, there will always be someone who tells you you're a fool and you shouldn't do it. Mm. And you've got to work out who are the people who actually have enough knowledge and experience to be able to tell you that and actually cut through it. Because look, we're all learning. We talked about that last week about, you know, the trying to work out, you know, how not to make certain mistakes. And one of the things we found really interesting recently is we did that, you know, big piece of research we discussed a few weeks ago. And in that, we included 40 brands. And we've been looking at the profile of each of the brands and being able to sub-segment down from like Fevertree, Schwartz, Barilla, Bellazoo, you name it, and actually looked at who's buying their brand. And I think one of the stuff that actually really is interesting is actually getting your hands on the data and understanding of stuff, because I think that's the stuff that allows you to move beyond emotion, because then you can't argue with it.
And
I think
it's
you
science,
need that.
Because it's science, than,
and
yeah,
you've got
opinion.
Fact there. And I think that's the really interesting thing, is actually being prepared to sort of try and dig into that stuff. And I think it's where the numbers actually really help. It's about bringing that combination of the emotion and the kind of...
As long as you've got good data.
Yeah.
Again, Jason. I would say that there's not one way to skin a cat. I'm working with a really interesting brand at the moment called The Black Farmer. And he's a black farmer, and he's got a brand of meats and sausages and things like that. He bought a farm down in Devon, and the locals started calling him The Black Farmer. And he was like, well, this is a really interesting name for a brand. And he did a focus group on it, and he did some research on it. And everyone was like, no, that's a terrible name. It feels, you know, it makes me feel uncomfortable. You know, is it racist, or is it this, or is it that? And he was like, well, sod that. My instinct tells me to go for that. You know, the data tells me one thing, but I, in my heart, feel that that's the thing to do. And he went for it, and it did really well. So I think that the advantage that we as emerging challenger brands have is that we don't rely on the safe data. We don't rely on the focus
groups.
But
I do think that's the difference between how you shape your brand as opposed to who's going to buy what you do and who your market is. And I do think you need to do some research. I do think you need to, you know, maybe take what you do on the high street and ask some people what they think, or go to some farmers markets and get all that sort of feedback.
Yes, but
as people, well as looking at other sort of, you know, market data.
I agree with you, but people don't necessarily know what they want.
Oh, but there's a difference for me between, you know, classic focus group question is this the right name for a brand? Which,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I would argue, you know, with The Black Farmer, that was a bad question to ask, probably because people's inherent racism would come through in all sorts of complicated ways.
It's not
ways.
Open-ended either.
But actually, I think when you're wanting to understand stuff like, okay, what percentage of people visit butchers? What percentage of people are doing this? I think it's about differentiating between, you know, do you understand the dynamics of the market? Do you understand how people are behaving and what their choices are, what their drivers are, and that stuff? That's the stuff I think you often need to get to. And I think it's how you, I think it's how you use data in a creative process, and that's the complicated part of it.
I think my approach would be to take the product to market. It's so easy to test a food product. Why ask lots of questions? Take it to a farmer's market, try it, get the face-to-face feedback. They may have never tried this product before.
I mean, I think I can't remember the sports brand that does rugby tops and all that. It was a famous rugby player, and he makes consumer rugby tops, you know, for leisure. And what they do is they do a short run of the latest design. They'll then do it on their normal mail order stuff. If it gets picked up, they then go for it. If it doesn't, they just shut that thing down. But he's obviously reached a critical mass where he can do that.
Yeah,
and I think what they've decided is some of the things that you're saying is they've decided they can't work out what people like.
Absolutely.
And therefore what they do is they just trial it each time.
Yeah.
But I do think Ollie's got a point. I think you need to understand the mechanics of your sector, because he clearly does. Cotton traders, they're called.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
You know, I do think you can't blindly go into your market without understanding it a little bit. But as you say, you know, maybe you should just go for it and chance some of the stuff.
And it's interesting, you take The Black Farmer, he's in a really complicated position nowadays because all the stuff around, you know, meat safety and all the kind of issues around it. And, you know, if you're running effectively a brand in a food product space, you know, we've had the Willow Farm issues, we've had all the Two Sisters stuff. If you don't understand the moving data of what's going on there, you know, you're in major trouble. And that's not about using that data as a development process thing. That's actually about using the data to understand actually where consumer trends are, you know, growth in butchers, move away from supermarkets, all that stuff. And if you don't get that stuff,
it's going to be difficult.
You know, it's very difficult. I think that's my kind of view on, you know, what's got to try and understand where stuff's are.
And I agree with you, but I do still think that you can spot an opportunity from just being a consumer yourself.
Of course.
And I think that there are so many obstacles already to starting up a food business.
Don't worry about it, go for it.
People don't have the money to do loads of market research.
Sure.
Yeah, that's
true. You know, I totally get what you're saying. You need to go in with some research. You've got to, I'm not saying just blindly do things. But
And what about brand? What are your sort of, you know, recommendations in terms of getting together the look and feel of your product? Because that's really important, isn't it?
Really fundamental. But on the other hand, one of the biggest mistakes that people do, or one of the most common mistakes, is to spend a shedload of money on branding, then take it to the retailer. Mm. They got all their packaging and their branding done, and then the retailer says, well, you know, it's the wrong shape, or it's the wrong size package, or, you know, it's too feminine, or it's too masculine. You should, my advice, again, there are loads of ways to skin a cat, but start off, do the minimum you can that take to create a kind of prototype that you can then take to retailers and get their feedback.
So that you can flex? So that you can
absolutely
take, so
you could
that,
be adaptive.
Right. Okay.
Well, if you go down the wrong path too far and you spend a lot of money, then it's you're going to get more personally attached to it as well, I think. So then it becomes even harder to detach. And I think you have to approach everything with that kind of testing mindset. Whether you start with loads of data and research or whether you just go for it, it's what you do next, which I think is important, which is gathering some insight and then using that in an intelligent way rather than going, oh, well, I want to do it this way and ignoring all of the advice if it's there.
I think the hardest thing, actually, in all the research I've ever done, packaging is the hardest thing. I think it's impossible.
It's very complicated.
It's impossible to test. And I remember doing a piece of research across Asia where there was one thing that basically killed the entire piece of research. It was impossible to test anything because we'd made one decision that was a bad global decision, which basically coloured every single piece of packaging. We were into an 8-market test and there was nothing we could do. There was literally no learning because one colour change we'd made was just destroying everything.
Right.
Wow. And it was, the global guys who commissioned it were a bit gutted,
Will, what have you done in terms of your gin, which we're going to talk about later? Did you do lots of research to start with, or did you just go for it and do obviously quite a lot of preparation work, but then a little bit see where it
took
you?
You're asking if you drank a lot, is that right?
That's what I'm looking at.
I've turned my hobby into my career. It's really interesting sitting here, so far listening to the conversation and in a room with brand experts and entrepreneurs, because I often describe myself as when people reflect that onto me and say, you're an entrepreneur, you do this, and I say, well, actually, I'm not an entrepreneur, and I'm at the other end of the spectrum. I'm an enthusiast and I'm a producer, so I'm kind of learning right now what entrepreneurs kind of know and have internalized really, really deeply. So did I do lots of research? Yeah, I mean, I did. My kind of journey starts a long, long time ago producing, but I did a master's degree in distilling and
I want to do that. Yeah. Did you do it? I didn't know you could do a master's degree in distilling.
It's kind of the feeder course for the Scotch whisky industry. So it's in Edinburgh at Heriot Watt. And a lot of the
good
the,
place to be. Nice city.
Yeah, it's good company. It's unfortunately.
That must be a fun group.
Yeah.
I mean, you must have made some good friends.
The Scots know how to drink. I mean, all the pubs are open so much later than they are down here. I was up there.
I mean, started that in my late 30s. I didn't get to benefit from the kind of freshers week that I might have done, but I tell you what, if you get a room of distillers in a room together, then it can be pretty boorish about nerdy booze, so it's not quite as party as it might be.
So what sort of research did you do in terms of deciding then? I mean, obviously you decided you're going to go into that area because you've gone and done a master's degree. And how did you, what sort of research did you do for this?
On the brand, really, it's been intuition decisions. Flavor-wise, did I go out to the marketplace and do tasting panels? No. On the brand, did I go out and do lots of testing with buyers? No. I didn't have the money and I didn't have the time. I had to kind of bring this product to market relatively quickly and definitely very cheaply. So I, as I said, I did a lot of the work through intuition, and that kind of, I feel certainly with the branding and the kind of knowledge I gained from the masters, but also knowledge about the industry, I got pretty close to where I'd want to be.
Well, we've got Jason here, so that's going to be good, because he's going to give you a little bit of a critique in a minute. So you've got some free consultancy here. That's a good job.
Well, I mean, to be fair, when you came in, the packaging was really interesting. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, these, relative to a lot of spirits brand, these are definitely much more kind of graphic designy as a kind of concept. And I chose a little brand team to work with because they were kind of new to the spirits marketplace, and because I had an idea that I wanted to have more of a kind of graphic design style to my brand. Now, you can tell me if I've achieved this or not, but what I'm trying to get with this brand specifically is really good shelf appeal, a really premium finish, but also a kind of a craft ethic to it. So it's been handmade. I mean, I'm the distiller as well as the founder, so this is all handmade stuff. It's all hand labeled, and I think they've managed to capture that really nicely.
Jason, come on, then, you're
I think you've nailed it. It's got bright, vibrant colours there. It's got a bit of traditional side of things. I mean,
bold, isn't it?
It's bold, and it definitely stands out. What I would want is kind of, obviously, this is you. I want to kind of see you, presumably your stories on the back, and I can read all about you, because I think this is where we're connecting with the kind of millennial consumers, is kind of telling our story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do a lot around sustainability, and that's really core to my business. And people ask about that because it's the kind of lengths to which we go to achieve a sustainable business is way beyond what most people do. But I want people to buy my spirit because they taste amazing and they look beautiful. And then once they've had that experience and they scratch beneath the surface, then they're rediscovering that sustainability, and they get that story all over again.
And this is a brilliant technique. And not that it's a technique, but other people have used it, like Karma Cola, for example. Mm. You don't discover until you delve in that there's this amazing story behind it. And because of that, the discoverer becomes a real ambassador. They've discovered it themselves. So once they become your biggest
fans.
Your fans, yeah. Yeah.
And Toast Ale, you might say the same. It's the same, type of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But I mean, the founders of Toast Ale are very clear. It has to be a blooming good beer in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, and then when you scratch underneath that, there's an amazing, there's you so know, charitable story underneath.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so I really, you know, we do a lot of on social media, as you have to these days, but if you look at a lot of spirits brands with social media, you know, beautiful cocktails, lovely serves, you know, pictures of bar shelves and things. And you look at our social media and it's fermenting raspberries and it's kind of, you know, pumps, like
the
pumping
nerds,
bums around.
The nerdy, nerdy version of
yeah,
of
I guess. You know, yeah. I want people to kind of really feel the kind of the work that's going on in the distillery when we're going and picking up surplus produce from our farmers. I want people to kind of experience that.
But Jason, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, you could research and really find that millennials and you know younger sort of drinkers are really interested in the ethics, the sustainability, mm-hmm. Food waste, and you could pick that up as a trend and mm-hmm. go, right, I'm definitely going to find a niche in here, mm-hmm. you know, or it happens just to be what you want to do anyway, and maybe you're lucky enough to hit the zeitgeist at the right time, whereas maybe 10 years ago that might not have been, you know, quite so good. But it's a bit chicken and egg, isn't it, Jason?
It
sometimes.
Is, and I think, but to be honest, I think we've got to give consumers enough credit that they can, you know, they can sniff a rat. Mm. If they think that this is an opportunistic thing, then they're not going to believe, they're not going to engage with it nearly as much as if it's an authentic, yeah. you know.
You will be
passion.
Found out eventually.
I think so, yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. The social media, I think you will.
The word authentic. Like, you can tell when somebody is, you know, putting it on, but when it's so ingrained in the whole experience, you know, it really comes through.
Yeah, and I'm pretty close to it in this world, so I kind of see and am aware of a few brands where it kind of getting
like an
into the, yeah, a little bit, and certainly the kind of manufacturing process is not as kind of rock solid from the sustainability process, and I think that's really, really dangerous because integrity is so critical.
You will get found out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You definitely will.
I say this thing about, I mean, I always sort of twitch slightly this whole millennial conversation because, you know,
I don't mean millennials. No, I know you don't. I mean people under 30.
No, but it's interesting. There's a big article today about saying that the largest group of obesity is amongst millennials. And if you look at the data around, you know, statements like I'm interested in where ingredients come from, only 21% of under 25 strongly agree with that statement. Amongst foodies, it's in the 80s. So I think it's a very dangerous thing to think that, you know, brands like yours is nothing to do with generations. It's to do with there is a group of people who have a philosophy around food and a philosophy on life. I'm not a millennial. I'm prepared to pay for quality products.
Me too.
And that is driven by not age. It's not driven by gender. It's not driven by where you live in Britain. It's driven by certain people who are passionate about food and therefore want to discover brands like yours that have a story. And they care about the idea that people have created
it's
stuff.
People sharing the same values. Yeah. That's the cluster. Yeah.
But yeah. I think if we're talking about sustainability and mission-driven brands, I kind of strongly believe, well, it goes back to this bit of research, seeing as you're interested in research, that Sainsbury's did a couple of years ago. They interviewed their buyers in terms of their ethics, what they thought of Soil Association, RSPCA, Red Tractor kind of stuff. And they compared that to what they bought in their basket. And there was no correlation. Everyone
really?
bought based on money, on economics of it. You know, what was on offer, what wasn't on offer. And I think that what the opportunity here with brands like your gin is that if you can offer the same quality product at the same price, but with a great story behind it, that's where you're in. Mm. I think, do you see what I mean? Mm.
So those aren't your sort of weekly, I've got to get home and I've got to get the washing up liquid and I've got to do this rush, and you know, I've got to take the kids here, so I'm doing my weekly shop.
Yeah.
This is the, it's the weekend now, I've got a bit more time, I'll have a browse. That's that type of purchase. I'm obviously generalising.
Yeah, but if you've got, say, a Sip Smith against that, against your product, go for yours because you've got the great mission behind it, you know.
Yeah.
If that,
yeah,
it,
I mean,
does...
Talking about entrepreneurs specifically in the spirits market, I mean, Sipsmith is a example of a really good brand, and a good product, and they make it themselves. And really, after that, you had a big rush of entrepreneurs to the business, it's fantastic, as you're describing, can bring a product to market incredibly quickly and have the experience and the wherewithal to do so. And so a lot of the kind of growth in recent years of number of brands on the market have been that the brands are kind of contract made. And they're quick brands to market, whereas, you know, brands where it's like myself, where we're market making it, and our cost base is much, much higher. Well, we can still bring it to market at the same price point. Obviously, the margins are much smaller, but the story's so much richer, and the longevity is so much.
But if you can get people in there with a comparably good product with a comparable price, and then they discover the story, then they will come back and choose that. In theory, they will choose that because there's the extra value of either the story or the sustainability angle or something like that.
Do you think a product can have integrity and have embraced contract manufacturing?
Yeah, I think so. As long as you control the quality and the ingredients and you take absolute control of it, I don't see why not. But you would often get done,
don't you?
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, you know, look.
If you talk to Pippa Murray of Pippa Nut and people like that, they really, really insist on utter control. Otherwise, their brand's out the window.
Apart, yeah.
But it's interesting because your thing is about 100 million. You are manufacturing this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the guys at Silent Pool are doing the same. Yeah. I mean, they're kind of other guys like that. But there are others, as you say, that are gins that are merely contract. And then it's just the story.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And you know, they're good products. Contract distilled gins are good products. They're made by people who know what they're doing. But where for me it gets difficult is when the brand owners will use language creatively to give the impression of one thing. Yeah.
It drives me nuts. That I hate it. I actually think it's going back to Victorian times when people stand in the street and they'd con you into buying some medicine because it's going to do this, that and the other. And you see pictures of some jolly farmer holding a big fluffy chicken, and actually, if you look on the packet, it's not free range. It's giving the impression it is, but it isn't. And I think that's immoral, actually.
I mean, in the early days of specking my brand and working on how we presented it, I was thinking very much about, you know, how do we bring in that notion of honesty and integrity into the brand? And eventually the way I've done it is just to be 100% honest about what we do and not even talk or think about anyone else. As long as we're completely honest, then that's going to come across.
I mean, I think the leading brand of sausages, which I can't stand because I know what goes in them, you know, I think they pretend they're some ancient recipe from a country, which I won't tell you where it is, but because you'll identify them and they'll sue me. But, you know, the reality is they're made in a horrendous factory in Birmingham or something, and all that rubbish about here we are with these recipes. I think it stinks.
But Sue, what has changed is that now with social media, that we have this
they can call people voice are finding out.
Directly to everyone, so they can get caught out. So now you're able to communicate directly with your consumer. They can see behind the scenes, tell your story, and it will shine through.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Jason. I'm sorry to cut across you here, Ollie. I'm glad you said that because we're going to listen to Will's story in a minute about how he's come to get with the brand and how you make it. We're just going to have a little break for a minute, and then we're back with you in just a couple of minutes. And you just joined us back in the studio with Will Edge of Green Sand Ridge Distillery and Jason Gibb of Bread and Jam. Do you want to just do that noise you wanted to do all along? Go on, Ollie. There we go.
That's a good noise.
So, yes, we're just opening Will's schnapps. That's good. So we've got some schnapps, not some gin. Before we... I know Guy's got his nose.
So good.
Guy's got his nose firmly stuck in the bottom. Before we allow these guys to taste your stuff, Will, explain to me exactly about your mission in terms of the product, which we know is true and authentic. But tell me about your mission.
Yeah, well, once you get kind of beyond making amazing spirits, kind of world-class spirits that taste great and look amazing, we have this differentiator, which we wouldn't want to be a differentiator in the longer term, but is for now, which is where we're a sustainable business. And so that manifests itself in three ways. It's mitigating the bad things about being a distillery, so energy use, water use, these kind of things. It's having a positive impact on our community, and we do that by using as much as we can surplus produce. And then it's trying to be a voice for influencing consumer change around premium products and encouraging consumers to when they're buying luxury goods, use sustainability as a buying decision, which isn't kind of traditionally. Mm.
But you haven't got that in your labelling, which was going back to sort of Jason's point, really. It's just a strong gin brand or snatch brand or whatever. It's very strong. I'm sure it'd be very strong on a shelf. You can see that it's handcrafted. So really what you're doing is you're getting people to buy with their eyes or whatever it might be the first time. And then if they really like the product, as you say, they will then start to find out there's these much deeper layers of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, that's right. And it's one of the reasons I've called this spirit a raspberry ghost. It's actually a play on the German name for this spirit, Himbeergeist, which literally translates as raspberry ghost. But it creates some kind of, you know, a question about what it is. And is it a gin? Which it's not, but it looks like a gin because it's lovely crystal clear. And then you kind of read back on the back of the label. And the back of the label gives a little bit of an idea about what we're doing with surplus produce or food waste, as you know, we can talk about in the safe environment. I don't usually use the term food waste with my consumers directly. But so this is a spirit I make with
food rescue.
Surplus, yeah, surplus produce. Entirely.
And what exactly is schnapps then? Why is that different from gin?
Well, again, schnapps is one of these terms which isn't in the legislation about what it specifically is. But this is an unaged fruit brandy. So gin has to have juniper in, and gin has huge amounts of complexity in. This spirit is one of the narrowest flavor profiles of any spirit that I make and that exists. So it's a raspberry spirit. All it has in is raspberries, but it's not what we'd call a macerated spirit. So I'm not steeping raspberries in the spirit. So it's crystal clear, and it doesn't have any of the sweetness that you have from a liqueur. So it's a really unusual spirit.
So how do you get the flavour in there then, if you're not steeping?
I'm distilling the raspberries. Oh, okay. So when we distill the raspberries, you get the aromatics coming through, but you leave all that sweetness behind. So what you get is a really unusual...
Sorry to laugh.
You're kind of...
Ollie's just glugged the mouthful on his face. You just interrupted him, though. do carry on, but your face, you're really chuffed with that, aren't you?
It's very unusual because most of the time we as consumers, we drink a raspberry spirit. We're attuned to a kind of almost a sickly sweetness. And this spirit...
It's almost like a cordial with a spirit added. Yeah.
So in drinking the spirit, you get all the sweetness from the tonic. So it's a very subtle sweetness, but you get a kind of very crisp, fresh raspberry
really good
character.
Oh, wow, that is crisp. You're not allowed to drink?
I'm trying to not drink
smelling.
In the week.
I smelt it.
It smells amazing.
It's worth drinking it. It doesn't count. It is amazing.
I might take this home for Friday night.
you can buy a bottle and take it home.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Where's very available? Clean. It's very clean, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not fruity. It's
funny because, you know, I'm a big fan of the Sip Smith Pimm's. It is them who does it's not a Pimm's.
They do a summer cup.
They do a summer cup. I think it's absolutely delicious and so different from Pimm's, which is just so sickly sweet and horrible. And that kind of reminds me of that fruitiness of it, but it's just so clean. I mean, it's lovely that
it's incredible. I mean, even before tasting it, just on the nose, it's just raspberries in a glass, but then it's got that kind of...
But it's not sweet raspberries. No,
but
not
sweet.
I don't know how to explain it, no.
Yeah.
It's essence of raspberry. It's raspberries on a bush in a farm or something, not in a supermarket. It's been picked. I know that sounds stupid. It's got slightly earthy niceness to it, I think, and very, very clean.
Yeah,
steely.
You're right with the earthiness. I describe it as a, you know, the autumn raspberries, which on the misty morning you have a slight earthiness to it, rather than that, kind of
that.
bright summer crisp aromatics. Yeah. Mm.
So, Will, I imagine that one of your keys to success is getting people to taste this. So, do you have to spend a lot of your budget on tastings?
We spend a fair bit of time on tastings. I mean, most of our marketing at the moment is directed at the trade.
Right.
So trade events and trade tasting events and supporting our trade customers. I think the direct-to-consumer marketing will come a little bit later in our growth.
I always find that interesting because, I mean, maybe I'm just really unadventurous when I go into a pub or a bar, but you know, generally what happens is you sort of go, what's on the cocktail list, and you pick something. I mean, you know, it's a shame. I think it must be really hard to be discovered in that environment. You know, you walk into this bar, there's 500 bars of different spirits. You're never going to say, you know, I want that one there.
You go for what you know, usually, yeah.
But that's why Will's customer is not you. It's the barman.
And making cocktails.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you'll lose the magic, actually, of this, which is the magic of this for me is this straight with tonic. Lovely, but if it ends up as just a mixer in a cocktail,
sure.
You're never going to know.
You're never going to know what you've drunk,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, so and you'll lose.
You might get some volume and stuff. Yeah. But you wouldn't get. I mean, that's a real discovery brand. I think.
And it's delicate actually.
Yeah.
In a way.
Mm. Yeah. So this is for me, it's an interesting spirit, and probably another example of where I differentiate from the kind of classic entrepreneur, because I could have made, instead of using the surplus raspberries for making this spirit, I could have made a raspberry gin. I could have taken my gin, steeped raspberries in it, and released a kind of sweet liqueur version of my gin, which is way more commercially desirable than the spirit I've made. For me, this spirit is so different. It's the only one of its kind made in the UK. It's a lovely spirit, and it develops that conversation about what is this, why is it different, and how do you make it? Oh, you use only food waste to make it. Oh, that's really interesting. And it kind of opens up a different set of conversations than just maybe a more commercially viable raspberry gin liqueur wouldn't do.
But this is this is a mature drink as opposed to I make raspberry vodka and raspberry gin, and it's good fun. But it's sort of, I wouldn't say childish, but it's sort of a beginner's thing, and it's fun, you know, and it's got a very fruity taste, almost like, even your grandmother would like it, because it's sort of...
Well,
it's not
so sweet, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
When you make it at home.
Yeah, I don't make it too sweet, but it does feel like that, whereas this feels like a really mature, grown-up...
Mm. Refined, delicate
drink. Yeah, really, really nice. I like it.
It'd be great in the summer. Really, really good.
Might be better than Ollie's... What do you call it?
You're not going to bring up my Arak,
that stuff.
I'm trying to get that guy on the program. I mean, I love a good Sri Lankan Arak with ginger beer.
Oh, there's Colombo Distillery.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
I know the other.
And you've also got a London Dry Gin there. So how are you making that?
So our choice of spirits is dictated by our ethic of working with farmers to try and use surplus produce as much as possible. So we make gins, fruit brandies, and rums, and we use surplus produce for a lot of spirits exclusively. So the raspberries and the raspberry schnapps, apple brandy we make a plum brandy, like you might get Central Europe.
Did you not bring any of that in?
All in. it's tucked away in barrels at the moment. So that's
you can
one
come
of,
back.
That
you're
smells
welcome,
nice.
You're welcome to come
yeah,
back.
It smells very nice.
Yeah, so fruit spirits, we always, just like in cooking, we develop the flavour in fruit spirits with a little bit of sugar. And the sugar in this raspberry schnapps is coming from the tonic, and in a barrel aged spirit like my apple and plum brandies, the sweetness comes from the barrel. So actually the fruit spirits are so delicate that you need a little bit of sweetness to kind of develop the spirits. We make a rum from something called blackstrap, which is the waste from the sugar refining industry. I'm fortunate, I suppose, in the fact that we have one of Europe's only cane sugar refineries in the Thames estuary, so I can take what is their waste and make a rum with it.
This is a really good story, isn't it, Jason? And a really good platform for a brand, do you think?
Absolutely. And you got to, dare I say, exploit it as much as possible. You know, there are, I assume you're in Selfridges, for example. They do a lot of stuff on food waste and anti-plastic and stuff. And there are some really high profile chefs who are into it. And you got to kind of align yourself with them and get them on board.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, when you say anti-plastic, so I'm zero plastic in the distillery. I'm zero waste and zero chemical use. And I've kind of got a slightly braver about using the term zero waste, because, you know, my gut feel is not to use the term zero waste. I always say I aspire to be zero waste, because there's always these annoying little things like some, you know, suppliers sending me stuff that I can't recycle, for example. But for me, it's a real question. As a business, if you use the term zero waste, where are the compromises in your process, and can you mitigate those, or is it just something structural within the industry that you can be a voice for change, but actually you can't immediately rid that from your business. So it's an interesting one that you might have a perspective on.
And aren't you on renewable energy as well? So like all of the, as you were saying earlier, there's quite a lot of energy consumption in distilling because of the heat.
There is. So he's 100% renewable power from the grid, but we work with a good renewable power supplier. And again, that's a slight compromise in our process because it limits the kind of equipment we can have, but that's fine. All of our waste goes to feed local small holdings or goes to a biodigester on site. So
it's brilliant. He deserves to do well, doesn't he?
He does. The challenge is really telling that story on.
I think so.
Instantaneously.
Getting that across and getting it across in bite-sized information.
There's so much to get across that it's, you know, you couldn't put that whole thing on the back of the pack because your pack would need to be, you know, five times the size or the print would have to be so tiny. But there's, all sorts of interesting ways to tell the story for sure.
And where are you at the moment? So how far down your journey are you? Have you managed to get into mainstream supermarkets or are you just selling to delis and farm shops?
Yeah, so at the moment we're working with independents and we're having conversations with larger distribution, we're a year and a half into our existence and spending a lot of time getting spirit into barrels as well. So we're in the middle of this gin renaissance at the moment, which is great. And we met our gin won a gold medal in the World Spirits Masters amongst other awards. So it's a fabulous spirit, and it's made with all of that sustainable ethic and great local flavors as well. But the gin renaissance is morphing and will continue to morph. I don't think it'll decline. But those brands like mine, where we're putting spirit away in barrels and broadening our offering to consumers beyond kind of flavored gins and these kind of things is that'll give us slightly more longevity.
And can I ask you about vermouth? I mean, I actually really quite like it. Probably a bit old-fashioned. But people are steeping, and using botanicals in spirit. You don't see so much of that in wine. And yet it can make the most amazing drink. Does anybody think that might actually become a trend at some point?
I think it will become a trend. I mean,
it's not as alcoholic for a start.
Well, yeah, and not least because of the amount of wineries now coming online, especially in the Weald, in our part of the world. So the wineries are, they're exponentially growing in number, which is great. And so we're going to have an amazing local supply of great produce. I think the challenge with vermouth is just consumers aren't attuned to it.
Mm. And yet the botanicals in a vermouth can be incredible, just as much as a gin. And when you consider how we've got that on our doorstep here in the countryside, I don't quite understand why people aren't doing that with wine and not just spirits. Mm. There's nothing in your research, about vermouth, no.
But these behaviour changes take so long. Yeah. I mean, you look at the fact that, 5% of the UK cook Japanese food regularly. Like, Japanese food is all over our high streets in terms of sushi and all the big retailers sell it and stuff. And yet, we're sort of 20 years into that revolution and it has not yet picked up. I mean, I think one just forgets how difficult it is to change consumer behaviour. It takes a lot of people all pointing a lot of energy in the same direction and a bit of luck and a bit of kind of, burning platforms to get
there. But so many cocktails, good cocktails, grown-up cocktails as opposed to the sort of creamy ones with umbrellas in, but they have a vermouth base or they have a that sort of bitters base, and yet people don't seem to be pulling that out as an individual.
Yeah, remember, as we said last week, only 23% of the UK make cocktails, and that cocktail is going to be a pretty simple one. It's not, it's probably gin and tonic. It's not.
That doesn't qualify, surely.
Well, someone said to me, "No, it's a soft drink." The other day, which I think was actually a fair comment, which said more about
it is in my house.
Exactly. you find the self definition here, but I think it's too early, and I think anyone's pushing it.
Yeah, I think as a spirits brand is a volume business, like a lot of foodstuffs, and having a handful of bars buy a vermouth for. Well, maybe more than a handful, but buy a vermouth for a cocktail listing is one thing. But you really need to rely on thousands of consumers buying it for gifts.
Mm.
But that's why I think the comment you made about actually getting into the chefs and aligning yourself, there are a group of people who, in your case, are well aligned in this. You know, Luke Holder's doing a whole load of stuff at Lionwood at the moment about zero plastic. And there's a load of these chefs who are well aligned in this. If you can get them on board, they will choose you above all else because you align with their ethics. And actually, if you can get into that universe of sort of ethical alignment, I'll call it, which is beyond chefs, it's into, you know, power consumers and the rest of it, you've actually, that will help, I think, catapult the growth.
Very much so. I'm just going to change the subject slightly. Jason, bread and jam, again, we'd recommend that to anybody who's aspiring to be in the food business, and that's on October the 4th and 5th this year. You've also got the Food Hub. Do you want to give us a quick rundown on what that is?
Yeah, so...
as if you're not doing enough already.
Yeah, well, I haven't told you about my vegan brand, but we'll save that for another time.
Okay.
I was a food entrepreneur running a business on my own. It was a very lonely experience. A friend of mine used to organize like a founder's meal. We'd all get round the table and we would talk really boring stuff like barcodes and chilled distribution and all this kind of stuff. And finally, like I found my tribe, you know, I could say what I wanted to say and people would find me interesting. And just being in that environment of other people going through the same thing as you, and but those often that those occasions were few and far between. So I wanted to create a virtual community of supportive people going through the same thing as each other. So as an experiment a couple of years ago, I started a closed Facebook forum, invited you know, the 50 food entrepreneurs I knew onto it. And then it just has grown and grown. And basically you go on there and you can say, you know, I'm going to pitch to Ocado next week. What shall I say? I need a barcode. I need insurance, or I need some people to taste my products in Whole Foods. And you'll get, you know, 5-10 answers from people. So it's a really, it's a collaborative, open resource and forum for people to share information.
And just just online though, just an online swapping of.
Sorry, yeah, it's on Facebook.
Yeah, it's on Facebook.
A Facebook group. It's a closed forum. You can't have people there looking for work or anything like that. You know, there are no marketing companies or PR companies.
Yeah,
it's all people supporting each other.
Why did you do that on Facebook rather than LinkedIn? Because I always think that I'm interested on that decision.
Why did I do it on Facebook? Because the generation that I was trying to communicate or build a community with, I think we're using it a lot at Facebook a lot already. I don't find LinkedIn that useful for those kind of answer forums.
It's not a very accessible platform in my experience
either.
I think
in terms of imagery as well, it's difficult to manipulate.
Yeah, I mean, the Food Hub is fantastic in that it's such a vibrant community. Like, so I dip in every now and again, and With a lot of these online groups and forums, that, you know, someone puts a question out there and, you know, it's just tumbleweeds, there's no response. But there's, you know, it's very, very active, like always, every day, lots and lots of posts, you know, highly recommended for anyone in the industry.
And can anybody just join that, or?
So they have to request to join, and I just check that they're, because it's for UK people, because it's all about what's going on in the UK. So as long as they're in the UK, I'm
and they're not trying to sell.
And, you know, if they are, I block them out. But I do think in terms of what you are asking, Ollie, Facebook are obviously quite focused on building communities because they're adding lots of features that really help communities grow. So,
And that's, if you go on to foodhub.co.uk, presumably you can get signposted to the Facebook group.
Probably not.
No. If they just go on Facebook and do a search?
You have to search Facebook for Food Hub Forum, and there are, go for the one where about 3,500 people on there.
You find it there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ollie, you've just got, before we finish today, you've just got a quick point about using social media for your brand, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's understanding who owns your followers and what you're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's why I was talking a bit about that LinkedIn versus Facebook thing, which is obviously none of us have got the firepower to build the technology required to do this stuff ourselves. So obviously we are using third-party platforms, Facebook, LinkedIn, any of these ones, to build our community. But the difficulty is that you do not own that data and you do not own that relationship. And so, you know, if you go back 8-9 years, people were buying likes on Facebook, and this idea was you then built your community and your community could reach you. Nowadays, you have to pay to reach that community, and basically Facebook's latest algorithm changes have essentially wiped out the reach of organic. And I think that's what entrepreneurs need to be careful about is, I think a lot of entrepreneurs spend a lot of time building up their Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and other feeds. And that's great. But you've just got to remember you don't own that data. And so you've got to make sure you're clear about what is the role of that data? How are you transitioning it? How do you build your community? How do you make sure you get email addresses or home addresses and you can start to build that audience to reach out to? Or if you haven't reached the stage where you can do that, at least just understand that you don't control that because it does block a route to market.
It does sound unimaginable, but I mean, something could happen and they change, I don't know, business tactics and suddenly you don't have any of that data.
It's not unimaginable.
I mean, it is what Facebook have just done in their latest algorithm, which is with publishers and brands, they have said that ultimately Facebook are prioritizing friends and social stuff versus businesses and publishers. And, you know, lots of publishers have talked a lot about this. Their traffic has been wiped out. And the same can happen to brands because in the end, you build a group of 1,000, 10,000, 20,000 followers. And Facebook just decides that your particular post should be paid. And they have a fair argument because in the end, they make their money. They are a business and they have the right to say, you know, for you to reach these people, you have to, you know, pay a cost per thousand. And, you know, I just think we all need to be aware that, you won't be able to ride the gravy train of Instagram.
You may be held to ransom at some point. So.
Yeah, or charged for what you need.
So you need mechanisms to make sure you start to capture, not obviously forgetting GDPR coming in, exactly. but understanding how you might capture that so that you own that data at some point.
But to an extent, if like brands like mine, I what I try to encourage and what's most useful for me on social media is where people are communicating to their friends and family and being vocal about my brand. And that's way more useful than me than doing a really targeted kind of sponsored campaign. So
it's growing ambassadors and advocates.
But the difficulty is that Facebook, let's say you have 1,000 followers or likes on Instagram, is that actually you may not be able to reach those people going for, you know, we saw on Facebook is that's what Facebook did. You know, brands had, you know, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 followers, and then actually a post didn't reach those 200,000 people. It reached zero unless you pay for it. So there's just we have to have an acknowledgement. This is not our platform. Mm. These are not our platforms. You know, there will be at some point, I would assume, a paywall gated on all of them.
Mm. So don't rely on it then.
Don't rely on it.
Leverage it while it's there. I mean, you know, Instagram. Yeah. I think, you know,
but understand exactly how it works.
We could do a whole show on this, couldn't we?
We could do a whole show on that.
Maybe we should.
Well, we're coming to the end of the show, and I'd just like to say thank you so much to Jason Gibb at breadandjamfest.com.
Yes.
I got that one right. Thank you. And again, I would absolutely advise anybody who really wants to understand the food business or is planning on launching something, go along. It's October the 4th and 5th. Tickets are on sale now, even though all the speakers haven't been confirmed, but they're always amazing speakers. So please go on there and there'll be a link from our website. And thank you so much, Will. Really like that raspberry schnapps.
Very good.
Mm, jolly good. Good luck with it. It's a great story. And for me, you're doing everything right.
Where can we buy that? I don't think we've said that.
Yeah.
You can buy it on our website directly, greensanddistillery.com, or in your local fine food store. And if they're not stocking it, you can
ask them. Why?
Why
have you not got it? So that's greensanddistillery.com. So greensanddistillery.com. And again, there'll be a link from our website. Recommend the raspberry snaps, not something that I think is familiar at all, and really nice and different. So well done. So you've been listening to the Food Talk Show. We're now syndicated all across or everywhere, whatever. Thank you to my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Food Rush, stop laughing at me, Ollie, and Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. We've got the Food Talk Awards coming up in June. Oh, it's going to be brilliant. We've had loads of stuff there. So if you want to come along and meet me, Ollie, and Guy, probably wouldn't want to, but if you do ever want to see us, you know, in the flesh, we're going to be presenting, aren't we? And so there's some great stuff there. And if you go onto our Food Talk website, there's loads of details. So I'd definitely get a ticket if I were you. Plus the fact there's amazing food to try and eat on the day, so that's great. If you want to get in touch with us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow, please do that. If not, just download our podcast from iTunes or from foodtalk.co.uk. Have a good week. Bye.